ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
As an adult, talking about race can be one of the most difficult conversations we can have. It requires us to recognize our own biases and our attitudes in a way that can be unsettling. So if we're having a tough time with a topic, how should we talk to our children about race? On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to meet a UWM faculty member who's trying to answer that question through her research. Erin Winkler is an associate professor of Africology and Urban Studies at UWM's College of Letters and Science. Welcome, Erin. Good to have you on today's program.
Thank you. It's a joy to be here.
Erin, why is it so challenging for us to have these discussions about race, both amongst ourselves and especially with our kids?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Part of the reason it's so difficult to know how to talk about these issues with children is because we're often not sure how to talk about them with one another, with other adults. And so when I do trainings with parents and teachers and community members on these issues, the very first bullet point under what can and should we do is always get comfortable talking about race, racism, and racial inequity with other adults first. Because if I can't explain to you as another adult why, for example, we see patterns of racial inequity in our own city, it's going to be very difficult for me to explain it in an age-appropriate way to a four-year-old. Part of the reason that it's so difficult for us is that it's not just intellectually difficult. I mean, these are very complex problems, but it's emotionally difficult. So there's feelings of guilt, shame, anger, resentment tied up into this. And generally, those are emotions that humans wish to avoid. And so we often do a lot of avoiding talking and thinking about these things.
We bring a lot of baggage to that conversation with our kids because we were kids once too. And in growing up, I suspect every one of us, if we're honest, would say we haven't always behaved or acted the way that we should when it comes to respecting or talking about people of other races.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that happens is that we haven't been taught about a lot of these things. So we want to explain to a four-year-old why we see these patterns of racial inequity. But we weren't taught those things in school, sort of how to understand these complex histories. And so we don't often have the knowledge, which can then be embarrassing, and difficult for us and brings up these difficult emotions. But I always tell people that guilt and shame are not useful emotions in this particular conversation. So it's not our fault that we were born into a society that's stratified by race and that perpetuates this kind of racial inequity. So let go of guilt and shame. They're not going to help you in this conversation. However, it is our responsibility to recognize those things about our society and to take responsibility for making changes. And so guilt and shame lead us to avoid these conversations or feel bad about the things we don't know or can't explain. Taking responsibility is what we need to do to really recognize the ways in which inequity is built into our society and do something about it.
Does it make any difference if we're white versus black? Is it more difficult for one race than another to have these conversations?
Well, it always makes a difference because our society is so deeply racialized that I think there's almost no situation in our daily lives where race doesn't matter in the way in which it's been built into our society. Now, I can hear listeners recoiling when they hear that in the sense of, well, aren't we supposed to say and think and teach our kids and work towards the ultimate goal of race not mattering at all? Absolutely, that's the goal. But we can't get there and unless we consider race. And so when I let me
so you
just
can't brush it under the rug.
Exactly.
You can't say, you know, just think good thoughts and
yes.
And you'll be on the right track.
And let me correct myself. I don't mean that the goal is a colorblind society. What I mean is that the goal is a society where inequities are not based on race. So not that we ever ignore race or the histories or cultures, the strengths that go along with them, but that we at the moment, we have such a racially based society where I can tell so much about the likelihood of a person's life outcomes based on race, and the goal is for that not to be the case. Of course, the experiences of talking to your kids are quite different based on the child's racialized context. And so a Black parent is going to have to prepare their child for encounters with the police or encounters with their teachers in a different way than a white parent is. So that's very different in terms of how parents have a burden of thinking about how to talk with their kids about race. But there are also some general things when I'm doing, you know, work with parents that there are tools that all parents can use as sort of the base rules or ideas or tools.
So give us a few examples. You know, if I've got a 5 or 6 year old, we were just before we came on the air, I was showing you pictures of my granddaughters. I've got a 3 year old, lovely 3 year old, lovely 5 year old granddaughter. I mean, is that too early to begin this conversation?
It might be. I'm not going to say it's too late. No, it's never too late, but starting as early as possible is wonderful. So we often think, adults often think that we shouldn't talk to kids that young about race because we think of them as sort of innocent, empty vessels who don't have these ideas in their head, and that if we bring
they're
it up—
They're pure, right?
Right.
We don't need to bother them.
We think of them that way. And so we think that if we bring up these ideas, we're actually poisoning their minds or introducing bias where it doesn't already exist. But the truth is that research shows that children are categorizing cognitively, non-verbally, by race, by 3 months— by 3 months of age. People often ask me, how do you know what a 3-month-old is doing? But these studies look at how long children gaze at a new face, someone that they don't know who's the same race as their primary caregiver or a different race as their primary caregiver. And we see consistent patterns. So they're learning to categorize. We shouldn't be surprised. We're teaching them, you know, their shapes and their colors and their animals from a young age. But categorization in and of itself is not a problem. It's when you add assumptions about what people are like or good at or what their values are to the categories in which you've placed them. And that's what we call stereotyping. And we see this sort of stereotyping or reasoning about people's behavior based on racial categories by 2 years old. When we do studies with children, asking them, you know, giving them different scenarios and asking them why those scenarios might be happening.
So that's why you said 3 or 5 might even be a little too late if they're already making assumptions.
So by 3 to 5, we actually see what we call in-group bias towards one's own group, pretty steadily set in. And that is where we do tests with kids where we give them photos of potential playmates that they don't know and ask them to choose a potential playmate. At 2.5, 3 years old, we see kids choosing a same race playmate from those potential photos of potential playmates. Now, interestingly, white children keep the in-group bias. In other words, white children rarely show anything other than a pro-white bias in these kinds of studies. But African-American children start moving away from an in-group bias towards a pro-white bias around this age of 3, 3.5. And this is where, you know, we see those external messages from society coming in that are privileging whiteness or giving the idea that it's a little bit better to be white. And these kinds of messages get in through who's the hero or the princess in the fairy tale. They also get in through, you know, what kinds of toys are available or all those kinds of things. But kids are also seeing patterns in the world around them. And so when they ride the bus through different neighborhoods, or when they go to the doctor's office and see who seems to have what kinds of jobs, or even at their school, who's the principal and who's in a support kind of role. If they see racialized patterns in their everyday lives, which they are going to tend to see because those patterns are built into our society, unfortunately, at the current moment, that's what we call structural racism. So it's not necessarily about individual hatred or ill intent, but about the ways in which structures have these built-in inequities into them. And by structures, I mean systems, you know, housing, schooling, so on and so forth. And so kids see those patterns. And we think that as adults, we're doing a good job protecting them by being silent when they're young.
By not saying anything. Don't call attention to it, and they might not notice.
But what we should know from observing our children is the world is their puzzle. They are trying to figure everything out, and they want to know the rules. And so they want to know, why does this block go in that hole? And, you know, they're learning the rules. They're testing limits and learning the rules. And here is a situation where they're observing and they believe they're learning rules. They believe they're seeing patterns about society. And no one is telling them why those patterns is happening. In other words, adults don't tend to do what I really encourage all of us to do, which is explain that these patterns are unfair. Talk about these patterns, talk about why they exist, and use the concept of fairness.
So let's talk about that, mm-hmm. because you know, I can imagine me trying to have that conversation with either my daughter when she was younger or now my granddaughters, and I would be afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. You know, I mean, am I going to screw this up? And you know, is it better just to let things be quiet because everybody seems to be getting along here? I mean, it takes a lot of courage for an adult to go ahead and begin that conversation, doesn't it?
It does. And that's my mission, is to help people find that courage and to give them the tools that they need to, you know, step out on a limb and begin those conversations. But what I'll say is, if we are silent, what we are doing is we are letting racial bias solidify in our children. Because what happens is they see those patterns. Also, when they're this age, their brains are still developing, so they're cognitively immature. And so they actually tend towards a kind of thinking that, not to get too academic, but that psychologists call transductive reasoning. And really all that means is that kids have trouble categorizing in multiple ways at once at this age. And so when they see people who are alike in one way, for example, skin color, they tend to then presume they are alike in other ways. And so the idea is, an example of transductive reasoning would be, well, I have brown skin and I'm good at coloring, so brown skin makes you good at coloring. So kids are, their cognitive development, their internal cognitive biological development factors at this age is pushing them towards that kind of thinking, which really encourages stereotyping. But again, it's not only those internal factors. If it were, we wouldn't see both black and white children showing pro-white bias. Those external ideas from society are coming in too. And so if, as adults, we choose to be silent, what we're letting happen is them solidify those ideas that I see these patterns around me, no one's telling me that they're unfair or why they're happening, and therefore I am going to presume that they must be based on some kind of meaningful and inherent differences.
Because otherwise the parent or the adult would have said something.
Exactly. And so if we choose silence, we think we're maintaining innocence, but in fact what we're doing is allowing racial prejudice to harden. And the bad part about it is it becomes subconscious. It becomes what we call implicit bias. And the scariest part about this is we may openly think, and this is true for adults, that we don't have a prejudice bone in our body. You've probably heard people say those kinds of things. And in fact, a person may not have intentional or conscious bias. But what we do know is that those implicit biases get set in from society very early. And stereotypes can affect our thinking, even if we don't believe them. Even if we consciously think, I do not believe a stereotype, a common stereotype in our society that we get from news media, is that black men are more prone to criminality. That is a false stereotype, but we are bombarded with it constantly through our news media and other forms of popular culture. And so this is a message that I may say I don't believe consciously, and yet studies have shown that these ideas get triggered in the subconscious and affect behavior.
Because you're conditioned after seeing story after story after story that that may present one race in one light versus another.
Exactly. And so these ideas get into the subconscious. And there's studies, for example, with both police officers and just the general public, where they're playing these video games that are used, for example, for police training, that the general public is more likely to pull the trigger in a video game when the perpetrator is portrayed as dark skin versus light skin, and that they do so, not only that they're more likely to, but they do so more quickly. So this is an example of someone who doesn't think they're biased, and yet they have those subconscious. I got off of your topic.
We're right on topic. And in fact, for listeners just joining us, we're talking about race, how to have those conversations, especially with youngsters, and at what age those conversations should take, and the path that you might take in your own home as you begin to talk about the differences that we have and the similarities. Our guest in the studio is Aaron Winkler. Aaron is an associate professor of Africology and Urban Studies at UWM's College of Letters and Sciences here on this edition of UWM Today. Aaron, as you talk about it never being too late to begin to have these conversations, I'm imagining that there are listeners right now who may say, but I am late. I haven't had these conversations yet. So how do you start? You know, if we're pulling a shade up and saying, you know, we really should not, silence is not good in this area, especially in a community like Milwaukee, where there's still so much segregation, and we don't see the mixing of races as you do in some other cities. How do you begin those conversations, knowing that the kids that they have in their homes may not be the young, impressionable 3 or 5 year olds, mm-hmm. but they might be 13 or 15 years old? What do you do?
Right. So you did ask me, and I got away from the question about, you know, how do we start these conversations? And of course, the way in which you can discuss these things will depend on the child's age. I won't get into a whole, you know, lecture on cognitive development, but how abstract or how concrete you need to be will depend on the child's age. But when I try to give people general advice about how to have these conversations, the first thing is always for adults to get comfortable talking about race, racism, and racial inequity, period. And not just talking about it in the ways that we tend to do that feel a little bit more comfortable to us. We're generally more comfortable talking about culture and history and heritage than we are about talking about inequity, racism, power differentials, and those kinds of things. So often with younger kids, adults will talk about multiculturalism, which is positive. I want people to do that, but leave out the part about imbalance and unfairness. And I'm using those words specifically because unfairness is something, if you have kids or if you work with kids, you know they are very into what is fair and what is not fair. And they have
because really, they see it in their own life.
That's right.
That's not fair, Mom.
That's right. So they're very tuned into that. And we can use that as a tool here. And so I ask adults, if you think about why this feels uncomfortable or taboo for us, it's largely because we don't have practice talking about it. We don't bring it up and we don't feel like we're educated on it. Well, if we want to break that cycle, we have to normalize talking about race with our children when they're young. And I encourage teachers to do this in their classroom. I encourage families to do this at
home. Even if it's uncomfortable. I mean, that first, it's like talking about sex the first
yes.
time, right?
It's, hopefully this will be a little
don't
easier.
Don't want to go there necessarily, but you know you need to.
Mm-hmm. And so when people ask me how to do this with a young child, it can be something as simple as I feel – here's something from a parent, a white mother in Milwaukee with a 4-year-old son. She was driving. They lived on the east side, and they started their day at the Whole Foods, the big shiny Whole Foods on the east side. And then they drove west on North Ave. And as they drove all the way out to the suburbs. And as they drove, her son noticed that once they were in this neighborhood that had what he said mostly brown people – he didn't see a Whole Foods. And so, in fact, he didn't see where are these people getting groceries. And so this was something, you know, for her that I encourage her to address and talk about how it made her feel, but also talk about how it's unfair. We tend to want to use colorblind language with kids. It makes us more comfortable to say things like, it makes me sad, or I don't want to hurt feelings, or I don't want to be bad. The problem with this is we're not helping kids understand those racialized patterns that they see. So I really encourage a parent in this case to really say, do you think it's fair? Tap into that keen sense of fairness. Do you think it's fair that over where we live, where most of the people look like us with lighter skin or what might be called white, we have this great grocery store that we can go to and get all the food we need. And here in this neighborhood, where you are noticing people look brown or what we might call black, you don't see that same kind of grocery store. Of course, he didn't think it was fair.
But so that's a great example of being out there in the community and experiencing and witnessing your surroundings. Let's talk a little bit about how the consumption of media might also allow you to have these conversations, because how many of us sit around the dinner table and you know, the TV is on and you know, top of the 6 o'clock news, you know, if it bleeds, it leads.
Absolutely.
And I worked in news and I know that that is just the nature of what is different. There's something, a disturbance that said, this is not normal. And so we're going to talk about it. So often that not normal story is one that involves a crime, and often race is a factor there. Is that a opportunity to trigger this conversation also?
Absolutely. I often tell parents that even if you are living somewhere that's entirely racially homogenous, maybe we have listeners in parts of the state who are living somewhere where they feel like they don't have these opportunities for cross-racial contact. What we call critical media literacy is always an avenue into these kinds of discussion, because there's always examples of stereotyping and racism in media. I do want to backtrack and say one thing about the using fairness as a way to get into this conversation. I don't want to leave out the very important fact that you also need to empower kids. So what we don't want to do is tell a kid, hey, life's unfair, now you know, good night. You know, that's going to leave them at best, you know, confused and at worst despairing, especially if in that example, the child was white. If we think about an experience where perhaps it's a black child and they're being told life is unfair for you, you will face these kinds of imbalances, that can have horrible effects on a child. So it's very important to empower.
And that may be an opportunity in empowering to talk about what sort of life, what sort of a career, what sort of a job that student might have that might bring about fairness, right? I mean,
so we really want,
kids are all interested in what am I going to be when I grow up?
So we really want to show kids role models in their community that are working to make things more fair. What we don't want to do is make it seem like it's racism is only our responsibility if we're individual bad people who hate other people. And if we don't, therefore, it has nothing to do with me. What we want to show is that this is a problem that takes active social justice work, and there are people in our communities doing that work. So, for example, around the issue of food and grocery stores, there are many examples of people in Milwaukee doing food justice work. And so this is something that we can empower kids and also get them involved. So it's important to show them. Often when we tell kids about anti-racist role models, they're in the past, and it's not our intention. But what the takeaway message for children is that Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks handled this. Things used to be really bad. Thank goodness for, you know, the civil rights movement. They've handled it, and now we're all equal. Well, the takeaway message for kids can then be, there's no longer a problem. And when I see these inequities, it must be either, you know, deserved inherent differences or things people are doing to earn these differences.
It's so, an individual's fault as
right.
opposed to a problem with the system that these
exactly.
people live in.
So we have to show them that it's still all of our responsibility and that there are people doing work every day. I also encourage us to connect that past to present and future. So racism doesn't seem like just something in the past. It can be very hard with young kids to explain the ways in which racism is built into structures. But there are different activities, if we have time, I can tell you about that. I encourage kids to like build a spider web where I let the kids, you know, have a roll of string and they all tangle it up and build a spider web. And then I say, now untangle it. well, that is not as fun and takes longer and is harder. And that's a way you can explain, even to little kids, the unfairness that we're talking about in our society about race is really tangled up just like your spider web. And just like with your spider web, it takes time to untangle.
Let's talk a little bit about the college students that you teach. These are young, intelligent people who've come through the system. How comfortable are they having these conversations?
I have a wonderful opportunity in my classes to teach about racism. I teach courses specifically on racism, on how kids develop their ideas about race. And I would say that my students tell me that they are not used to talking about issues of racism in mixed racial company. So initially, they are pretty uncomfortable talking about it.
Just like we adults are.
Just like adults. And so they tell me that in their experiences in K through 12 education, just like we mentioned, they talked about culture, multiculturalism, but they didn't talk about power differentials, racial imbalance, racial inequity, structural racism, and especially not in the contemporary moment.
Even if they had black or white friends, friends of the opposite race, they still didn't have those conversations.
Exactly.
So, Erin, as you take a look at your research work outside of the classroom, where do you see yourself going in the next part of your study, trying to figure out how we untangle this tangled web of emotions and sometimes guilt and sometimes confusion?
Well, I'm really interested in how place comes into play in this whole process. So there are some universals that we've been talking about, but you have noticed that also we've discussed things about how, for example, in Milwaukee, place and how kids experience place or experience different spaces or travel through places influences their thinking about race. This is what I found in my research with African-American middle schoolers in Detroit. I wasn't going in looking for this, and yet what really came up was how much growing up in Detroit influenced this process for them. So my next project is in New York City, partnering with a wonderful nonprofit called Art Start that does creative work with marginalized youth in experiencing homelessness or in alternatives to incarceration. And with this organization, actually through a creative methodology where kids take photos of their everyday spaces and analyze them and curate them, we're going to be looking at how, for this group of kids, age 5 through 14, how place comes into play and how they think about race, develop their own racial identities, and understand and navigate racism in their everyday lives.
Capturing images that they themselves take.
Yes. I'm very excited about it. There's bringing in that creative process and really having the children active in the research is very exciting to me.
Well, let's have you, as you work through that next phase of the research, would love to have you back on and talk about what you learn in a city as diverse and filled with so many different ethnicities as New York City. Maybe some lessons you could bring back to Milwaukee.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Erin. Erin Winkler, Associate Professor of Africology and Urban Studies at UWM's College of Letters and Sciences, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. As usual, a reminder, if you'd like to listen to previous programs or come back and listen to this program again, you can always find it right online at wuwm.com/UWMToday. We've got a wonderful library of past interviews with faculty like Erin and her colleagues who have shared so much about the research that they're doing at UW-Milwaukee. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.